LA Talk Radio thanks you for being a listener. Did you know you too can host your own radio show with us? Go to our site at latalkradio.com or email info@latalkradio.com right now and start your show today.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'll be flying solo today. And please excuse the feedback. My co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, is focusing on his work as director of the Hazelton Betty Ford Center here in Los Angeles. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to many things that can make our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for your family. Now, our topic today is the alchemy of pain, but it's celebration and awakening. Our guest, Britton Devereaux, is Chief Clinical Officer at D'Amore Healthcare and is here to talk about how important it is for the mentally ill individual, the addicted, and or the loved ones to change the map if they want the destination to change. Britton has a unique approach, bringing her knowledge of change management, public policy, and business analytics to healthcare. She's focused on industrial organizational psychology, and her undergraduate work was completed once she gained her master's of science in addiction counseling, then attaining her licensed advanced drug and alcohol counselor credential. Britton is also certified by the NADAC, which is the Association for Addiction Counselors, as a master addiction counselor. Britton, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Good morning, Alan. Good morning, listeners.
Well, and thank you so much. Yes, and thank you so much for being here. And we send out a press release ahead of time that announces a little bit about you and about the topic that we're going to be talking about. And in this case, we received questions that have been sent in, but I also had people that just called me or that came up to me at the gym and said, hey, I hear that you're going to have somebody coming on and talking about this particular issue. And almost everybody went straight to the opioid crisis. I mean, that seemed to be the biggest topic that people were asking about. So I think I'd like to start there because, as you know, it's starting to get plenty of press these days. But share with our listeners what opiates are and how bad the crisis really is.
Absolutely, Alan. It is a concern for all of us, especially helping professionals and those of us trained in social work. The opioids, they're a class of drugs that include illicit drugs like heroin and illicit prescriptions like oxycodone, hydrocodone, codeine, morphine, fentanyl. You see a great increase in the accessibility to fentanyl here in Southern California as far as the efforts of the cartels right through the LA area. But I think more than anything, why somebody might be coming up to you and have that personal interest is how can we not, when there's been 33,000 overdose deaths in 2015. So just looking at the fatalities alone, we're all affected. And there's been a 267% increase in Caucasian overdoses, which is interesting when you look at the history of overdoses and drug abuse in modern America. 213% increase in overdoses among African Americans as well. So, Alan, your question comes to somebody with great interest in the same area, and we see it every day in the individuals that we treat.
Now, along those same lines, what are the increases in other aspects of America?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So there's been 137% increase between 2010 and 2014 in Latino Hispanic overdoses, and just mind-blowing 236% increase in Native American overdoses. So all of the opioid class, when you look at that, it definitely deserves a response, not a reaction, but a response from all of us as we look at the public health and the crisis facing us in terms of the family and our teenagers today.
Now, why do you think there's been this explosion of opioid overdoses?
Well, one aspect of that is accessibility. So when you have individuals that have modern day stress, just the normal stress of everyday living, they're going to have a response of some sort. Some of them, it's going to be a spiritual response based on their faith. Some of it's going to be clinging to their interpersonal relationships in their life. And others, it's going to be seeking health care. In some cases, individuals don't have these first three coping skills. And so they reach out to something that seems like will respond in a quick and effective manner to the pain that they're struggling with, facing. That pain could be mental, emotional, spiritual, legal, financial, social, and it causes a huge amount of turmoil because we want answers now, most of us Americans, and when we don't get that, we pursue something that may look like a solution in the long term, opioids, mm-hmm. other drugs, risky behaviors, or we dive into some other coping mechanism that may not serve us or our family or the community. And in the end, it has a tremendous impact in terms of fatality, overdose, which may or may not lead to death. And then, of course, the stress that it puts on the body, and so the immune system decreases. Mm-hmm.
Now, how much of this do you think is the accessibility to prescription drugs versus the accessibility to illegal or illicit drugs such as heroin?
Sure. So if we look at some of the statistics that the CDC has gathered for us, 54% of people who misused prescription pain meds received them from friends, relatives, acquaintances. So that's a tremendous statistic when we look at why are individuals graduating from illicit drugs like oxycodone, hydrocodone, codeine, morphine. Why are we graduating from there to illicit drugs like heroin and some of the other drugs that we can find on the street? Everything from heroin to other classes of drugs like ecstasy, MDMA. One drug tends to lead to other drugs because when you're in a bind, you just want to be altered of the mood or mind. So mm-hmm. a patient that we treat will more than not suffer from polysubstance use disorder as opposed to one singular drug of choice. They will graduate from one to the other. So back to your question, 54% of people misusing the prescription pain med are going to have to meet that need at one point once they become dependent on the drug. Their tolerance increases, the withdrawal symptoms, the onset of the withdrawal symptoms come, and it's very unpleasant. So individuals will pursue whatever drug, whatever means to relieve that pain, physical and emotional, mental, of course.
You know, we have a question coming in, and again, I want to thank those that take the time either to send these in ahead of time because they're going to be at work, or having the ability to go ahead and either email or instant message us questions. And this one, I think, goes right to this point that we're bringing up right now, because this one reads, I was in a car accident in which I suffered various broken bones and a head injury, as well as a collapsed lung. The pain meds that I was on for over a year were so addictive that I am now just finishing up a 6-week drug addiction therapy program to try and recover some semblance of a normal life. Can you talk about the treatment protocols of someone like myself? Because I'm not feeling very confident that this therapy is working for me. And this is from Joyce in Los Angeles.
First of all, Joyce, tremendous kudos. Congratulations for your bravery. When we talk about the alchemy of pain and the celebration of awakening, the biggest thing we're looking at is somebody that decides to change their life. And that takes a tremendous amount of courage. So first of all, congratulations to you. To your question, the idea that 6 weeks of treatment addressing withdrawal symptoms, tolerance, and the mental anguish associated to a drug dependence, is that enough? Is it not enough? The most important thing you can look at is that it's simply a foundation, Joyce. So once you have that foundation, now you're going to apply the relapse prevention skills and the self-care protocol that serves you, you as an individual. You are unique. There's no one that will ever be exactly like you. So you have unique desires and unique needs. And we have to come up with this being, you know, you, your counselor, anybody in your support system, the plan so that you can enjoy life, create memories as a sober individual, and have pleasurable experiences. So the faster you can replace the old memories and the old imaginations of pleasure with actual experiences of it today in your life, the better. That's really where the awakening begins. So I recommend evidence-based modalities like the anonymous communities. There's AA, NA, Celebrate Recovery. There's tremendous opportunities there. And then, of course, within any modality of continued and sustained healing, I recommend behavioral treatment. So CBT, DBT, these are modalities that you can receive from a therapist to help continue to change the behaviors and the feelings around the drug use or the dependence. More than anything, I would encourage you to develop some solid relationships with other sober women. These are the relationships that are going to help you more than anything. So that might start with a therapist or a coach, and it might lead to some relationships in an anonymous community, maybe at your church. But 6 weeks is a great foundation. So start from there and come up with your relapse prevention plan.
Now, Britton, first, I just want to thank you for that, because I love the fact that one of the first points you touched on was individual. The fact that we are all different human beings, I think, is something that at times is missed out there. And I know in dealing with some situations where something is becoming court mandated, well, now this person gets a court mandated on a specific period of time, as if the court at that point knows that there's some magic that's going to happen after that period of time. So I love the fact that you are explaining to them that it is an individual situation, and that there needs to be follow-up. There needs to be aftercare. And the best way to do that is to surround yourself with people that can help. So, yes, I completely agree. Now, again, as we're talking about in regards to drug overdose, I was looking at some statistics, and the one that I have heard lately is the fact that drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, surpassing auto accidents. Now, first, is this true? And if so, what is driving these numbers? No pun intended.
Absolutely. So, yes, that is an accurate statistic. I keep myself regularly up to date with SAMHSA, CDC, the NIH, and CDC informs us that we are using lethal drugs in a lethal way that are leading to fatality more than ever before. So you look at fentanyl, which was initially intended to be used on the elephant, and now we're using it on the human body, and it's leading to respiratory failure, cardiovascular failure, and failure of the other systems that keep us alive. So one thing that we know is we're not going to be able to fight addiction, substance use disorders, and mental health disorders if we actually cause suppression on the very systems that keep us alive. So one thing I would say to the listener who's struggling right now with an addiction is, if you find yourself moving from one drug to the other to alter your mood or your mind, please reach out for help. There are people that will listen There are people that are interested in your dignity and your value and your worth, your purpose as a human being, and you don't have to do that. You have people that will surround you and that will help you define a way to get out of this vicious cycle of insanity. To your question, Alan, when I look at the overdoses and the idea that it's an accidental death, I'm compelled to action myself. That's part of what gives me the passion every morning to do what I do for D'Amore Healthcare. This idea that D'Amore is of love, Italian for of love. We want to prevent accidental deaths. We also want to prevent the suppression of the immune system, the breaking of the family system, the wearing down of the community systems, and the tax on the criminal justice system. So if we can do that little by little, one of the things that we're looking to provide is reassurance to the patient. We acknowledge the patient as an individual, somebody that probably did not plan to bring themselves this close to death. Nobody wakes up at 6 years old and says, "Mommy, Daddy, one day I want to be a drug addict and I have to go to rehab. I'm so excited." This doesn't happen, Alan. And we acknowledge that in the work that we do. So when I think about accidents in the U.S. and thinking about what leads us to that, it happens usually very fast. Somebody had an accident like Joyce or a physical injury, and suddenly they're following doctor's orders, and then the next day they're not. They're supplementing it with alcohol. They're supplementing it with another pill or mood or mind-altering substance. I don't think a lot of the folks that are dependent on these drugs, Alan, want to be, and there's resources for them.
And I would completely agree. And now, as we're talking about accidental deaths, can you share a little bit about the chemical response to someone who has gone through rehab? And so they have gone through a period of time and they've gotten that particular drug out of their system, but then they backslide, something happens, mm-hmm. and they reuse. Talk a little bit about why sometimes that's the time in which the person dies, because of the chemistry of their body. They have now, they were using drugs for years, and their body sort of got to the point of accepting that. And now you've cleaned a system out, and now you've added in the same amount that you may have worked up to. Explain a little bit so that some of the people out there will understand why sometimes the most dangerous time for someone to use drugs is right after they've been clean.
Absolutely. Such a pertinent question. It happens more than any of us would like to think. Part of it is an individual's awareness. They need to be educated on what happens once your body is clean and sober from a drug of abuse. So to the foundation behind the question, the human body, once it's tolerant and once it's dependent on a drug, the human body wants more of it, right? And you can give it more, but mm-hmm. you will never get enough. You will get to the point where it's more than enough and it's fatal, right? This is a chronic, recurrent, progressive disease process. So the chronicity of it is to the point of your question, that if I am treated for my substance use disorder, if I am treated for my mental health disorder, or both, right, dual diagnosis, mm-hmm. it does not resolve the disease process. This is a lifelong recovery process. So when I use that drug after being sober for 12 weeks, it puts my body into complete toxicity. Because often I will use the same amount as what I did before sobriety. So we see this with patients that end up admitting to the ER or taken in by ambulance and found by a loved one because they had a moment of weakness. They did not apply their coping skills and they used the thing that was most familiar to them, their old comfort and support system. And no one can judge them for that. It's a decision that they made in that moment. What we can say in our follow-up to that is there's other methods to respond to that moment of discouragement and stress. Some of it is pharmacotherapy. Drugs like Vivitrol, Naltrexone, they'll actually block the opiate if used by the individual in recovery. So if I have been sober from opiates, from heroin, for let's say 3 months, and I have a terrible day or I have a great day, whatever the case is, and I just really want to shoot up again. I really want to go grab some Tylenol 3. And I do so, that Vivitrol on board or that naltrexone will actually block the drug. So I won't feel the euphoria from it. So I do recommend pharmacotherapies. I also recommend having and maintaining a sober network. That could include a counselor, a sponsor, most definitely sober friends. That it looks different for every individual. But one thing that we know is that we have to have a tribe. We have to have people that we travel this journey with, because they have to be there after that moment of shame when somebody's had a lapse they've just used once, or a relapse they've used several days in a row, several times in a row, and they want to bounce back. They don't want to go back into this habit. So if it's not toxic, which in many cases it's not with the right supports, now we have Narcan available at CVS. We have other things that can actually bring the person back. The ERs are run down with so many overdoses. But bigger than that, the doctor at the ER, the social worker, they're going to ask, who's your network? Who's your support system? Very same as what we do at D'Amore Healthcare. When you arrive to D'Amore, we're going to ask you from day one, who's in your corner? Who's cheering you on? Because no one can be, we can't assume that anyone won't make a mistake. But sometimes the mistakes lead us to our next great success.
Yes, and I love that. And I, you know, as you said, there is just so much more that you can get out of the situation by having loved ones around you that are going to help you through it. Yeah, I think that's just one of the most important things. Now, again, for many people out there that know that one of the things that we do at West Shield is we take at-risk teens and sometimes adults to specialized programs to deal with, in some cases, it can be an addiction. And one of the things that I hear from a lot of parents who really don't understand or don't want to understand when they're told that their teen is suffering from a mental illness, the parent is more thinking, okay, so just have them go and get drug rehab and then everything's going to be okay. And so, you know, this, they're told that their teen is suffering from mental illness, but they're also using drugs. How do you deal with those situations to where to get the, not only the user, but the loved ones around them to understand that the drug is being used more as a secondary issue? You know, can you speak to this subject and what the best course of action is?
Alan, when you first posed that question, the first thing I imagine, and I try to do so regularly when I'm working with families, is just to imagine the stress that they're under right now. Mm-hmm. Somebody that was born 15 years ago, 18 years ago, 25 years ago, somebody that's only 12 years old, whatever the case might be, is now in a mental illness and a substance use disorder and causing the family great fear and great stress. And so first of all, to any listeners that are going through that, I extend my sympathy to you. And also I want to empower you with information today that you don't have to struggle alone, that there are so many resources when it comes to mental illness, especially for individuals that want it. That's really what it often comes down to is, do I want to stay like this? Do I want to struggle from the highs and the lows, the mania? Do I enjoy this? Is there any gain from this for me? And at the end of the day, most people will get honest that this is terror and stress. So to that family, I say, in your stress, have a network. That network might look like Al-Anon. That network might look like your own personal psychotherapist or counselor. And as far as from my perspective as the clinical director and administrator for D'Amore Healthcare, what I would recommend is if you know that your loved one is struggling, sit down with them on their level. Don't stand over them. Don't talk down to them. Sit down together where you're at the same eye level to be able to hear their struggle. And you may or may not get much information from them, but remember that communicating is one of the hardest things for the person in the mental illness or the substance use disorder. So give them time, give them some space, and create safety for them. one way to create safety for your loved one is to look, maybe there's an IOP program, maybe there's a therapist, maybe there's an individual that's been through this before that can meet with us. You can find that in an AA meeting, an NA meeting, a Celebrate Recovery meeting, but you can also find it just by reaching out to some of the treatment providers like the Amore Healthcare. So one thing that we're going to do is look at each individual in the constellation of support, so that family system, and designate who can be in their cheering section right now so that they can get through a time of change and a time of sometimes detox, and most definitely a time of psychiatric care. The most important thing that the family can do is remove the stigma from mental illness or a substance use disorder and help to reduce the suffering. The family can't actually remove the suffering. That has to come down to the individual if they want healing. But as a family system, as a parent, as a sister, as a friend to somebody who's struggling or suffering, we can help reduce that by making sure we do not shame them, judge them, criticize them, but merely create safety by listening and providing some resources and being willing to share time with them to investigate those resources.
That's just, it's so well put. And I noticed as you were speaking that you come from a world of NLP, of neuro-linguistic programming, because it's something that we address also, that you always want to be at eye level. You always want to, you can do matching and pacing. If the anxiety has built up, you can match and pace and bring them down, but always keep them in a safe place. And I love that. Now we're going to take a break, but for anybody out there, if you want to follow along with us, you want to open up another page, you can go to deamorehealthcare.com. That's D-A-M-O-R-E, healthcare.com. You can open up another window. You can follow along with us. But as I said, we're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. And when we do, we're going to talk a little bit more about mental illness and some of the statistics out there as it relates to us here in the U.S. So stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Britton Devereaux of Amore Healthcare. And when we went to break, we were talking a little bit about the correlation of mental health and when drugs are being used, but used more as a secondary issue. So Britton, I mean, what are some of the statistics of those suffering from mental health issues in the United States today?
Sure. Great question. 9.8 million adults aged 18 and over in the U.S. have a serious mental illness, Alan. That is a startling statistic.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that is familiar to our school systems, to our employers when we look at productivity. It's certainly familiar to our officers that maintain safe neighborhoods and communities for us. Because mental illness leads to often criminalization or stigmatization. And when we look at mental illness in the modern family, lots of times it looks like accepted behaviors because it's so scary to change things, Alan. It is so scary to decide, I don't want this anymore. Living like this is not enough for me. So when I look at those 9.8 million adults, the first thing I feel for them is compassion, because nobody has to stay there. Nobody has to be stuck. But often in the period of waiting or the period of time before awakening and change, that pain that we've talked about before, the alchemy of it, looks like I'm going to solve this on my own. I don't need you, Alan. I don't need you, sister. I don't need you, friend. In fact, I don't need anyone. But what I do need is my primary support system. I need methamphetamine. I need ecstasy. And I need cocaine. And you humans, leave me alone. And so in my mental illness, the patient says, I don't know that any human being will ever understand me. What D'Amore Healthcare stands for is to reduce the suffering and the stigma, to improve the quality of life and address public health in a way that creates safer human beings and safer neighborhoods. So safe human beings are not necessarily something that's trained in us. Our motivations have to be inspired and led and fed. They're not created overnight because we were raised in a good family. It takes time to really look at how to motivate somebody to heal from a mental illness. To your question about how many people are affected, just something that I find interesting is 15.7 million adults have had a major depressive episode in the last year. Now, that might look like they missed 2 months of work. It might look like they filed for separation with their loved one. It might look like they've forgotten to pick up their little one from school. And it might look like when we don't know where she's at, she's meeting a drug dealer because she needs marijuana and she needs benzodiazepines to control her mood. These are all perceptions, Alan. And one thing that we do at D'Amore is educate people on what happens once we have been tolerant to the drug for a period of time, and how once we remove that drug, we can actually treat the psychiatric symptoms. So at D'Amore, the backbone, the vertebrae of our program is psychiatric, in the sense that our psychiatrist is going to look at the history, the behaviors, the biology, the social system of the patient, and come up with ways to address whether it's that major depressive episode or a reoccurring chronic mental health disorder.
You know, and I think you bring up a great point, because what we're talking about is that now there's so many masks that have been put on. You know, they're taking all of these drugs now that are masking whatever the true problem is. So what you're saying is that you have to go in and you have to wean them off of this just to find out what the real problem is. And I think that's a huge issue now for us as a society, because on the one hand, there are government entities that are cutting budgets so that there are fewer beds or fewer places for people to go to get help, but yet it is becoming easier and easier to get more of the drugs to mask this. And to me, this just looks like a recipe for disaster.
It is, Alan. And the disaster is now showing its face through suicide. And
yes,
that's one of the things that really inspires us towards the work that we do when it comes to the family, the support system, to help the patient prevent the next risky decision or dangerous reaction. Our desire is to create the response to the mental health disorder. So it's not what happened, it's how I respond to what happened. So if a human being makes a mistake, it's not the mistake that defines them, it's the response to the mistake. And so when I look at suicide prevention and I look at treating mental illness or substance use disorders, the first thing I think of is, who's listening to you?
Mm-hmm.
Who's giving you time? Because our families and our neighborhoods, our workplaces are so busy that often there is so much going on underneath the surface, and we want to solve the problem for the person rather than empowering them to be the pilot. So what we describe to the patient and to even to staff at D'Amore Healthcare is that you are the pilot. We, your support system, are simply the co-pilot, recording data and helping you stay on course. So I look at it like a cheering section. If I want to help prevent suicide, one thing I'm going to have to do is affirm an individual, recognize them by name, and like you said, on eye level, And I'm going to make sure that I'm hearing their deepest fears and their deepest concerns. And there's no way that I can do that without developing a connection or a bond with that person. And that's going to take time, the thing that most people think they don't have.
Right. And you're right, because it takes time to set up trust. It takes time for somebody to understand that you are making their situation a priority in your own life. And as you said, it just takes time, and we need to be there to listen to them, and which is why, obviously, again, we need more beds. We need more places for people to go where they know that they can be safe. It's a frustrating situation at times when we're working with people that we're picking up off the streets who are dealing with a mental health issue, but yet at the same time, we don't even know really who we're dealing with, because there is this now cocktail of different medications that they've masked all of the symptoms. So,
mm-hmm. And to the idea of the mask, Alan, it's very natural for an individual to have a mask. You wear masks, I wear masks, our neighbors wear masks, and that's okay. The bigger concern is, what does the mask lead to and why is it there? It leads to a sense of security. Now, no human being goes through life without a mask on at some point. There are days when we're sad and we're scared and we go to the dentist anyway. We show up to work anyway. And the biggest concern that we have with the individual that can't cope through life's unexpected events, can't problem solve when something is disappointing to them, is that they are more likely to reach out to a dangerous behavior or combination of behaviors and reactions that will interrupt not just their safety, but their long-term mental illness. That's why these two are so interrelated. The psychiatrist, the counselor, the psychologist would tell you that the substance use disorder and the mental health disorder are so overlapped. They're such close siblings that it's sometimes difficult to tell one from the other, right? The chicken or the egg, mm-hmm. which one occurred first. So when I look at how to address these things, I think of it as similar to using a map to reach a destination. Individuals recovering from a mental health disorder or a substance use disorder need a plan with milestones. They need evidence of progress. They need rest along the way to get acquainted with new feelings, and they need to let their new senses be stimulated to create forms of pleasure and healthy memories. So the family, the individual wearing the mask, the loved one that we had no idea that they were in such pain, it's very easy for us to tell them what to do. And sometimes they need an intervention. But more than anything, they need to know that we have positive regard for them, that we acknowledge them as an individual with dignity and value and worth, that they have purpose, that they're a phenomenon, that there will never be another person just like them, and they need to be lifted up. The Amore stands on a platform of positive psychology, Alan, so that we can help people reduce those masks and address what's underneath the layers of the mask.
You know, one of the words that I hear more than almost anything else now is the word stress. You know, you ask people, how are you doing today? Or, you know, with all the things that we've done for years and years, and the one word that keeps coming up is, I'm stressed. So, I mean, as you know, I mean, stress in the U.S. seems to be at an all-time high. What impact do you believe that it's taking on modern American mental health, and what are some of the things we can do about it?
Alan, I think that stress impairs our judgment. I think it impairs our insight, and I think it affects our appetites, it affects our relationships, it affects our spiritual bonds, and it certainly affects the interpersonal relationships that we have. So that sounds a lot to me like mental illness and substance use disorder. Stress, mental illness, substance use disorder all have the same impact on the very same dimensions of well-being. And it's profound how easily we minimize it to, well, this is just what it means to have this job. This is just what I have to do in order to maintain. This is just a time that our marriage is going through. Okay, so what's the stress response? The stress response cannot be that I will alter my mood or my mind, because I will become dependent on that process. The stress response cannot be, I will do this alone. But one way that we know stress impairs our insight and our judgment is that we believe an illusion. We have a distorted belief that it's better that I resolve this on my own rather than you help me. And this is the big element of the mental health treatment community that we endeavor to address, that nobody has to be alone to address something that is affecting every dimension of their well-being, legal, financial, physical, mental, social, emotional, physical. How can I do that on my own? That's impossible. That's absolutely impossible. So that's why at D'Amore Healthcare or other treatment providers, we're going to surround individuals with a treatment team. We're going to surround them with 24 hours of support and then other modalities like medication-assisted treatment, like behavioral treatments. We're going to surround them with a support system, even if it's an intermediary one, while the rest of their family heals. Maybe somebody else is in a mental illness or a substance use disorder in the family system. We're going to surround them with things like group counseling, group work, so that they can actually talk in a space where there's tolerance, love, and guidance. And then, of course, individual counseling, because a human being, an individual, needs to know that their strengths, needs, abilities, preferences, goals are being addressed by somebody who actually cares about them. The great lie of the mental health disorder is that no one cares. Go ahead.
And Britain, I mean, I love that. I mean, and that is what we should be getting in our families. That's what we should be getting in everywhere, is to be in a position where we're surrounded by people who are providing tolerance, love, and guidance. The unfortunate thing is what happens now when we come out of that cocoon and we now go back out into the public, to where we have a media and a political system that is providing intolerance and no guidance, except a sort of a controlled guidance of, you know, we're only going to be tolerant as long as you accept the guidance that we're providing, which isn't necessarily good for us, because we're now being told that, you know, you can watch every commercial. Hey, if there's any problem at all, just jump right on to Big Pharma, because Big Pharma is now going to provide you with that pill that's going to solve everything. So I think part of the difficulty that we have is that, you know, we're able to go into these great situations like you provide. How do we keep that going for us? And what can we do as a society to start to reduce this negative influence that's being pushed on all of us?
Mm-hmm. Let me start with the question as far as society, because I think a lot of it has to do with our perception in a sweeping nature of one another. It's very easy for us to conclude things about systems and society because we're all so busy. And there are tremendous messages sent to us every day by media, right? Music, commercials, Big Pharma, as you said. And of course, within all of that has to do with the services available or not available by our government. But within that perspective and that picture of society, what I look at is on that map of the 50 states, I see little dots all over it. And those dots represent family. And so as a society, I'm interested in the health and the wholeness of each family. And if we can look at the fact that sometimes we need a healthcare professional to guide us, right? A psychotherapist, a counselor, a drug and alcohol counselor, a physician, an addictionologist, a psychiatrist. If we can lean on them for a little help as a family, right? Not just one individual walking into the doctor's office, but maybe we go by two, right? That I don't know how to ask for help, but I need someone to go with me today. This is the very beginning of healing. So when an individual has been treated for 6 weeks, 10 weeks, 6 months, there has to be somebody in their support system that's going to be familiar with their recovery plan, with their action plan of how they're going to accomplish enjoyable, pleasurable daily life. Pleasure doesn't look like I get to feel happy every minute. It looks like I know how to problem solve through life's unexpected events. So these are what programs like D'Amore help individuals face, is their self-efficacy and their self-regulation. So back to the picture of the individual walking into the doctor's office or the counselor's office. From there, I stretch out my network by going to an AA meeting tonight or going to Celebrate Recovery. I stretch out my network from there by having coffee with somebody once a week, somebody that I care about who's listening to me, and I'm doing the same for her or him. These are simple, simple building blocks to maintaining quality of life. And it's very easy with our laptops and our cell phones and our iPads and our fancy cars to not give ourselves the space to heal. So that's why at D'Amore we talk about holding space so that somebody can actually have a chance to feel all their feelings, acknowledge them, and then start fresh on how they want to live their life. Not necessarily how they want to change their feelings, but what actions does it require to have the feelings that you want in your life today? There has to be a preamble to get the destination that you want, right? So that's the kind of the social response that I have. And then as far as the individual, I look at them with the greatest amount of hope and expectation because they have limited themselves. They, in many cases, have decided that I need these risky behaviors or I need these substances in order to feel okay about who I am, what's happened to me, or where I need to go. And that individual deserves compassion from us, because more often than not, the trauma of everyday life has worn them down. And that wearing process is affecting their immune system, as we said. It's affecting their relationships, and they feel isolated, alone, depressed, and anxious. That doesn't have to stay the same. All it takes is literally dialing a number, calling for help, asking a loved one, "Will you sit with me? I have some decisions to make." Or like so many people that I know, it just started by going to a meeting. Mm-hmm. And then things started to change. Because in this community, I as an individual am acknowledged as somebody that can heal and can change in a lifelong process. It's different, right, than other disease processes because I can arrest it, but it's going to be with me forever. So it's going to take a forever response and a forever patience. If we can give that to one another in our family systems, but more importantly, if we can give that to ourselves, then mental illness and substance use disorders will not have the tremendous impact they're having in terms of a criminal justice system and the productivity in the workplace, our financial affairs. Those things will also begin to improve.
We have a question that's coming in that really touches on this thing about reaching out or choosing not to reach out. And this one reads, "My husband's sister and father were both clinically diagnosed with bipolar disorder. My husband demonstrates some of the same characteristics with his mood swings and depression, but refuses to acknowledge that he too may be suffering from this condition. He feels all they can do is to put him on some medication like his family members are on, which he refers to as them being in zombie land. I am at my wit's end as it is greatly affecting our marriage and our children. What can one do when their spouse is in such denial and refusal to get help? What are the alternatives to medication?" And this is from Vi in North Carolina.
Vi, first of all, I would ask what psychiatrist the family members are seeing, because maybe they're over-medicated. So to your husband's question, if they seem like they're a zombie, they may not be being treated appropriately. So how often are there follow-up appointments and things like that? Because one struggle for the person with mental illness is to self-report and self-regulate with integrity, because there's so much stigma associated to mental illness. So that's for you and your family affairs. But the most important thing that they can have is a psychiatrist that they trust. Secondarily, to your husband, medication combined with behavioral therapy and treatment, time and time again, produces results, period. It takes both. So he will not be assisted by simply being on a medication. He will be assisted by learning who he is, right? How his body is made up, which is unique, having self-compassion for how his body is made up, looking at himself as whole, right? Those dimensions of well-being we talked about, he has concerns that are physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, etc. What is he doing to feed those elements of himself? If he can look at maybe two parts of that, we might help him get out of the denial. Now, probably deep within that question for him is, can this really get better? Can I really have hope from these mood swings? Is, will you travel this road with me? Will mm-hmm. you be supportive through this with me? Because if you are more interested in his healing than he is, that's one thing that will lead to your discouragement. But more often than not, individuals feel like they have to do this alone. And there are counseling appointments maybe that his therapist would have you join him for. There are open meetings and grief groups that you can go to outside of his recovery so that you can be fed and held and supported as you support him. So you can have tolerance and acceptance to him despite how fast or how slow he addresses this bipolar disorder. The mood swings sound like they might be pretty severe. So I would definitely say make sure you're getting support for yourself by.
You know, Britton, first of all, I want to thank you for that answer and tell you that I love it, because the first thing that I got out of it, and I hope that the listeners did too, is that first fix that thing that he's looking at that's saying he doesn't want to be. He's using Zombieland as his reasoning for not wanting to seek help. So here is an opportunity to maybe fix the situation with the relatives so that he can see that if their medication is altered and now they're doing better, maybe he doesn't see that as such a negative and now opens up to go ahead and get the help that he needs. So Britton, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I want to tell you, unfortunately, we are out of time. I've loved having you on the show. You're welcome to come back anytime. And again, for everybody out there, if you need to follow up or something, you can go to, again, it's www.deamorehealthcare.com. And if you're driving and you can't write that down, go ahead and go to the Answers for the Family site. We will have all of Britton's information on there if you want to get in touch with her. So Britton, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan, and happy Monday.
Thank you. And for everybody else out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, July 31st, when we will be joined by Stephen DeMille, Executive Director of Redcliffe Ascent Wilderness Program, and Dr. Mark Burdick, author of 10 Steps to Wilderness Therapy. And please share our show with your friends. Send them a link to visit answersforthefamily.com, or they can catch our latest shows on iTunes, where leaving a review will be much appreciated, and it will greatly increase our iTunes ranking and help us to expand our reach to more families in need. And last but not least, the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out our latest posts, and if you like them, please like or follow our page. Remember, be good human beings and go out today and do something positive for someone else. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polachek, only on LA Talk Radio.